Each year, The Brian Lehrer Show interviews the filmmakers behind the five Oscar nominees for Best Feature Documentary. The 2012 nominated films are Searching for Sugar Man, Five Broken Cameras, Invisible War, The Gatekeepers, and How to Survive a Plague. We've compiled the five interviews for you to listen to ahead of Sunday's Academy Awards ceremony. Enjoy.
Sugar Man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes.
The music of Sixto Rodriguez, and now begins our annual Oscar-nominated documentary series. We'll be talking to the directors of each of the five nominated feature documentaries. Jumper's Coke, Sweet Mary Jane. And why are we playing this song? Because first up is Malik Benjalul, the director of Searching for Sugar Man. It's about Rodriguez, the artist singing the song we're playing right now. Malik, welcome to WNYC and congratulations on the nomination. Pretty good for your first film, huh?
Thank you, sir. Yeah, exciting times.
And this film is about the search for Sixto Rodriguez, the singer-songwriter who so many people in the U.S. have never heard of, but who's had a huge following in South Africa since the 1970s. Who's Rodriguez, and how did you, a Swedish guy, get interested in him?
Right. Rodriguez made two albums in the early 70s to great expectations. The producers were working with Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder, and they said that this is better. This is the best album we ever made in our careers. And the album is released and sells nothing. It sells 50 copies. And he stops. You know, he understands, I don't have any talent. No one want to listen to my songs. And he starts to work as a construction worker in Detroit. He lives in a ramshackle house for 30 years. And then one day he gets a phone call, and it's some fans in South Africa who tells him that in South Africa, you are more famous than the Rolling Stones. And he hangs up the phone. He thinks it's a crank call. It's a practical joke. So they call him again and says, listen, this is true. Did you make an album called Cold Fact? Yeah, I did 30 years ago. In South Africa, that album is more famous than Abbey Road. And he had no clue. So that's in very brief the story.
So this happened by sheer word of mouth in South Africa without any record company push or anything?
No, it was this phenomenon. I mean, he sold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of albums. And
he must have known, right? He must have been getting the royalties, or was somebody stealing them from him at the record company?
That's right. I mean, he didn't get a penny. If you know, that's one way you normally understand you're famous. You get royalties. He didn't. He didn't get one.
What happened to him?
Well, what happened to the royalties? No one knows. I asked a few, the people basically who were involved, and then they all say, well, it wasn't me. But they all say it wasn't me. So who was it?
Here's a clip from the film of Steven Sugar Steverman, a Rodriguez fan who features prominently in the film and who heads up the search for Rodriguez, explaining what Rodriguez's music meant to South Africans in this clip.
The album was exceptionally popular. To many of us South Africans, he was the soundtrack to our lives. In the mid-70s, if you walked into a random white liberal middle-class household that had a turntable and a pile of pop records, and if you flipped through the records, you would always see Abbey Road by the Beatles, you would always see Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon & Garfunkel, and you would always see Cold Fact by Rodriguez. To us, it was one of the most famous records of all time. The message it had was, be anti-establishment. And the one song's called the Anti-Establishment Blues. We didn't know what the word anti-establishment was until it cropped up on a Rodriguez song. And then we found out it's okay to protest against your society, to be angry with your society.
And we'll play a little bit of Be Anti-Establishment coming up in a little while. But listeners, any South Africans out there by any chance who were influenced by Rodriguez? Do you agree with the take of Steve Steverman in that clip from the Oscar-nominated documentary Searching for Sugar Man, that this is what everybody had, Abbey Road by the Beatles, Bridge Over Troubled Waters by Simon & Garfunkel, and Cold Fact by Rodriguez? Anybody know this music? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we continue with the director of the film, Malik Benjalul. How did the record Cold Fact, that was the name of the album, which bombed in the States make it to South Africa in the first place? Was it a bootleg copy, or was it actually distributed there?
No one really knows how it initially went. There's some stories that there was this exchange student who got to South Africa and brought a copy. But very, very soon, it was a very, you know, completely official release. It was released by Polydor Records, is a major label, and that's why it became so huge. I mean, it was in every record store. You couldn't hear him on the radio because he was censored. In this time in South Africa, it was, you know, the apartheid society, it was very censored. So it was a state monopoly on radio. So there was only one station, basically, and that station, which was the apartheid, you know, the government station. And on that station, Rodriguez was not allowed to be heard.
Do you think his music had any influence on the movement against apartheid?
Well, so they say. I mean, I spoke to those people who were the igniting spark for the white anti-apartheid movement, and they say that it was a group of rock bands evolved in the early 70s, and they all say that Rodriguez was our main inspiration because he was the only one who sang anti-establishment lyrics. If you sang, you normally got banned. And somehow, Rodriguez only got semi-banned. He got banned from radio airplay, but you could buy the albums, and that's generally considered a mistake by the censor board. Normally, you couldn't sing stuff like "The System is Gonna Fall Soon" to an angry young tune, which is a lyric in one of Rodriguez's songs. So he was the one who inspired those young kids, college kids at universities, who said, "We can do something about this crazy society that we're living in."
So in the 1990s, long after all this, Steve Stieverman, who we heard before, decided to take it upon himself to figure out whatever happened to Rodriguez, because there were all kinds of rumors. The main one was that Rodriguez had set himself on fire on stage one night and was dead. So here is Steve Stieverman talking about his search for Sixto Rodriguez.
I've been looking for information about Rodriguez for a long time. I've even set up a webpage called The Great Rodriguez Hunt in the hope that someone out there in cyberspace would post a message on the forum giving us any information about Rodriguez. But there was nothing.
So how did the search end?
Yeah, so this fan basically, what he's looking for is the story on how did Rodriguez die, because in South Africa, Rodriguez is as famous and as dead as Jimi Hendrix, but there are different versions on how he died, and that's strange. You can only die once, you know, you only die once, so how did he die? And he started to search for clues on the, you know, there was not much information on the album, so he started to look for clues inside the lyrics, and he found a few geographical references, and finally they found references to Detroit, where they start to search, and they find a producer, and the producer tells him, "No, Rodriguez is alive. He's living down the street, basically. I call him and tell him." So they do. I mean, they call Rodriguez, and that's where I started the story. I mean, he doesn't understand what they're saying, so they say, just come here. So they convince him to come, and the airplane opens its door, and he's dressed in his working gear. He never, you know, and it's a red carpet, security guards, limousines, paparazzis. He kind of walk around the limousine because he thinks it's for some president in the plane. So the security guards go out on the tarmac and pull him inside the limousines. He watches out from the window of the limousine. On every lamppost on the highway, he sees his own face. Rodriguez live, Rodriguez live Johannesburg, Rodriguez live Cape Town. It's a fairy tale. It's insane that this actually happened the way it happened. It's like Cinderella or something.
And it's not a spoiler to say that in 1998, Rodriguez was discovered alive and well and living in Detroit. The film has plenty of stuff that is not that mystery, let's just say. And I don't know if you'd be surprised that we asked our listeners if there are any Rodriguez fans out there, and we've gotten about 8 calls. So we're going to talk to some of those people in just a minute. But first, I want to give everybody one more taste of the music of Sixto Rodriguez. This is that song you were talking about before, Establishment Blues, and that Stieverman refers to in the clip we played earlier.
The mayor hides the crime rate. Councilwoman hesitates, public gets irate, but forgets the vote date. Weatherman complaining, predicted sun, it's raining. Everyone's protesting, boyfriend keeps suggesting, you're not like all of the rest. Garbage ain't collected, women ain't protected, politicians using people they're refusing. The mafia's getting bigger, like pollution in the river. And you tell me that this is where it's at.
Rodriguez from Establishment Blues and Martin in Midtown. You saw him live?
Yes, I am, Ryan. Thanks for taking my call.
And I take it from your voice you're from South Africa?
I am indeed. I'm from Cape Town, South Africa.
And do you confirm the stories we've been hearing about how huge he was?
I confirm it 100%. And do you know what? The funny thing is I went to university in the 90s, and it was still a soundtrack for us in the 90s. In fact, I worked at the first general elections in South Africa, and we had the CD pretty much on a loop at the polling station where I was working.
Where did you see him?
I saw him in Johannesburg.
What kind of band did he have?
You know, we weren't very used to live acts out there, so to us it was, just a fantastic show. Artists usually only came out on their way to Australia in the 90s in South Africa, so for Rodriguez to have come out, I can tell you that it was just almost a spiritual experience being out there and seeing him perform live. And another rumor we heard was that he landed in South Africa without a guitar, that somebody had to buy him a guitar so that he could go and play the show.
Huh. Martin, great story. Thank you. Shireen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Shireen.
Hi. I have a funny story. My husband's South African, and I was living with him in Johannesburg for 6 years. And we were driving around and listening to the radio. It was like a solid gold. They were playing oldies but goodies. And on came the song, and my husband was singing to it. And I said, "Who's this?" And he said, "Rodriguez." And I said, "I've never heard of him before." And he said, "How could you have never heard of him? You know, he's from the U.S. And, you know, he's as big as Bob Dylan." And I said, I've never heard of this guy before. And it wasn't until I saw the movie that I made the connection. And I think it's so interesting that Americans don't know this guy. And he's just so big in South Africa.
Shireen, thank you very much. One more, Aviva in White Plains. You're on WNYC. Hi, Aviva.
Hi. Also South African from Johannesburg, and pretty much the same story to tell. You know, I just assumed that everyone in the world knew the music. I was completely shocked when I found that people had never heard of him. And the stuff that the movie speaks about him being, you know, sort of a subversive voice at a time where, you know, the government was incredibly repressive and oppressive. It's really true. I was about 16, 17 years old when his album came out, and my friends and I listened to it all the time, and it definitely gave us courage in terms of protesting the, you know, apartheid at the time. It was definitely the soundtrack of that whole part of our life.
How about that? Aviva, thank you very much. And we're talking to the filmmaker of Searching for Sugar Man about the music of Sixto Rodriguez, basically unknown in the United States, but a star at the level of the Beatles or Bob Dylan, as you've been hearing in South Africa, especially in the 70s and 80s. We're talking to the filmmaker Malik Benjalul as the first in our five-part series with all the directors of the Best Documentary Oscar nominees. So Rodriguez is now on a world tour. He's performing in South Africa this weekend, I understand. He'll be performing in New York in April. Is he a reluctant rock star, or has he embraced stardom now some 40 years after he tried to be a star?
He's a reluctant celebrity, but he's not a reluctant rock star, I would say.
What's
he loves
difference?
Performing. He, uh-huh. he loves singing, and that's so he's very happy right now, actually.
The Oscars are on February 24th. Good luck. You're
Thank you.
Already in L.A. As a first-time filmmaker, how is all this buzz for you?
It's insane. It's surreal. It's absolutely crazy, those last weeks. A lot of fun, though.
Are you committed to being a filmmaker now that your first one was a hit?
I don't know. It's a very exciting job. I mean, it's tell stories is the most beautiful thing you can do. People, I think it's very to give people some kind of emotion. It's beautiful, and I wish I could do it again.
What else do you do? What's your day job?
None. I guess basically set editing for 4 years, 1,000 days. I spent editing
this film.
This film, yes. I have to find out what to do with my life now.
Do you have a next film in the works?
I do have ideas, so yeah, hopefully I will.
Just one more thing. I wonder if this story could even be repeated in today's music industry. Rodriguez could have released his music on YouTube and would definitely have known if he was super famous in South Africa. His whole life would have been different, right?
That's right. It's three things. I mean, it was South Africa during apartheid, so it was a very isolated country. It was a man who was living in a house without a telephone, so he was very isolated too. And it was a time before the internet. Now I guess it can't happen.
Well, Malik Benjalul, nominated for Best Documentary for the film Searching for Sugar Man. Thanks a lot again for joining us today.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you.
We'll have the directors of four other nominated films next week. We'll end this segment with another song. Here's Inner City Blues off of the Cold Fact album of Rodriguez. Sugar Man, by the way, Searching for Sugar Man is playing at the Village East Cinema.
Going down a dirty inner city side road, I plotted. Madness passed me by, she smiled high, I nodded. Looked up as the sky began to cry, she shot it. Met a girl from Dearborn early 6 o'clock this morning, Colfax. Asked about a bag, suburbia's such a drag, won't go back. 'Cause Papa don't allow no new ideas here, and now he sees the news, but the picture's not too clear.
Ryan Lehrer on WNYC. Now we continue our Oscar series with the directors of the five best documentary nominees. We're doing 5 days in a row. We started on Friday. Today, Imad Bernat and Guy Davidi, directors of Five Broken Cameras. This is a first-person documentary narrated in Arabic by the filmmaker as he protests the building of the Israeli security fence in the West Bank town of Baleen, protesting by videotaping the townspeople's daily encounters with Israeli police and with people from the expanding Israeli settlements coming further onto disputed land. So, Imad and Guy, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on your Oscar nomination.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Imad, since this is your story, tell our listeners when and why you got the first of your five cameras and why you started recording encounters with Israeli security.
Yeah, I got my first camera in 2005 in the when the village started to protest and to demonstrate against the construction. In the same week, my son Jibril was born, so I wanted to take part of the struggle of the what's happens in my village with my camera, so to film and to document, to follow the events for many purposes. So in the same time, I was filming my son in the family and inside the house, but nobody realized that the village will continue so long time in the struggle and protesting against the construction. So week after week, it's became more strong, and people came from over all the world to participate. Israelis activists and the people gathering to. And Friday to demonstrate against the construction and against the settlement. So I thought that it will be more strong in the next few months. And people came to make films also. They came to ask for footage because I was there for 24 hours. I lived there, and I was the only one who followed the events and document everything. So I gave them footage. So I started to think about making a film, making a documentary.
You became the town photojournalist.
Yeah, as in the village, we live in a small town. My village is 1,900 people, so to be there with the camera, the only person with the camera, so it's very important for the people even in the village.
I should mention, by the way, that Five Broken Cameras is currently in a theater in New York. It's at the Quad Cinema. And maybe you can describe Baleen a little bit for people who've never been there or seen it. I was struck watching the film by how rural it looked on the Palestinian side of the fence. And as the settlements were being built further and further in on the Israeli side of the fence, how much it looked like a city with high-rise apartment after high-rise apartment building.
Yeah, I remember before 15 years that how's the village and how's the place and the mountain around the village and the valley and the trees. It was very beautiful. And year after year, so it became more, you see, constructions and more houses in the settlement. And the settlement, it is getting close and close in the last 15 years. So when you look now from the village around the village, you just see settlements and construction. So we live in small village and not so big town, and when the decision was taken by the Israeli government to build the wall in the middle of our land, so that's mean we lose about 55% of our land go to the Israeli side. And so that we decide why we decided to protest and to demonstrate against the construction, because we lose everything, the olive trees, the field, and the, most of our land, because the plan was to build the fence close to the village, to the houses of the village, that give more space to the settlement to grow up and to make more construction.
Guy Davidi, what's your role in this film? This again is Amat's story. Almost all the audio in the film is his first-person narration of what's taking place in Arabic. What's your role?
Yeah, you know, film is an art form. You have reality and you have a film, and they are not the same. You have to carve a story from the life. And in order to carve this, you have to know how to tell a story. And I think also for me, from coming a bit from outside, was easier to guide Imad through this process, which was very painful for him also, because it became a very personal process at the end. I was an activist, an Israeli activist coming to Baleen right in the start of the event in 2005. So I spent a long period of time. I was doing first of my films there also. For my first documentary feature length, I stayed in Baleen for more than 2 months. And for me, this was a very important period to understand what are the consequences of occupation on your personal life, on childhood, on emotional life, on all these issues that afterwards... were part of our discussion when we created the narration for Five Broken Cameras, and when we decided together to construct the film around Imad's personal life and his family and his son. So I was there with Imad to shape that process of creating the story, of building the story from all the live events, because there are so many live events and so many drama. And at one point, you know, when you see this hundreds of hours of footage, you get, also me, we all got lost in it, because everything is dramatic, everything is important. So how can you create and carve a story that has a sense of progress, that this violence and all this suffering means something at the end?
Imad, you got a, well, the film repeatedly shows you and other people from Baleen being shot or otherwise roughed up by Israeli security forces. It's extremely shocking to watch some of this. You even record the killing of one of your friends because you happen to be shooting. What kind of historical document do you think you have here?
I think I myself was very close many times to be killed, because I was shot many times by soldiers and my cameras, and I was recording my friends and my brothers getting arrested by the Israeli army. So for me, it's more than just to film or to document. For me, that was my responsibility to keep filming, and was it was my part in the struggle to keep filming, for the purpose to show the world and to spread the footage and to make this film. So it's something that connected me me to the camera and to the land and to the place, and we related always to the place. So what's going on in my village is also related to me and to the camera and to my son and to everyone.
This was reality for you, obviously, much more than movie making.
Yes.
And yet you got a positive review from the New York Times chief film critic, A.O. Scott, who called it difficult but necessary viewing and said it's hard even to review it as a film when it depicts such stark reality and political trauma. But while it is another piece of Israeli-Palestinian advocacy journalism, he says it is also, as a film, a rigorous autobiographical work of art. And I wonder, can you see your film as a work of art in addition to a document of reality as experienced by you and your neighbors?
Yeah, I think it's an art, but it's an art related to the reality. It's more reality. It's more the situation, the daily life. So for me to mix that, the arts and the reality and your feeling to the place and to the situation, to mix them together, so you can make a very strong art and very strong documentary. So it's for me. It's not just a documentary. So for me, it's life. And many people, when they watch this film, they just get inside the story and they feel inside the story. And even people who watch the story and the film, they feel inside the story. So it's not just a documentary or a film. It's something related to the life and related to the place, and that's what's important. Because it's a story that's tell from a personal perspective, from a Palestinian perspective, and because there's many films were made by people who came from outside, and so there's not related to the place by their mind or their feeling or
the personal experience.
Yeah, yeah.
My guests on WNYC, as we continue our Oscar series with the directors of the 5 Best Documentary nominees, Imad Bernat and Guy Davidi, directors of 5 Broken Cameras. Guy, is it significant that you, as his co-director, are Israeli and he's Palestinian?
You know, for me, the whole process of making the film is very painful as well, personally, because my role is never understood of how I helped to shape the film, and a lot of artistic decision that made the film what it is, because obviously for Imad it's his own personal story, but for me it was a challenge how to tell that story in a way that will create passion in people, and the way that they will feel committed to the story, and the way how you evoke sincerity, because sincerity is not something that is a given, it's something that you also build in the narration. So the first challenge that I had was that my role will never be understood, and then I will always be put in that label of the Israeli director, in which people are assumed that maybe I'm there just to beautify the film, or maybe I'm there just to bring money or whatever. But I'm part of that story, and I'm, and I think the film is made also in my shape and in my voice and with my tone, and I can delve into that. But this is maybe not the time. So actually, being labeled as the Israeli partner is not very convenient, because I cannot find my artistic place in the presentation, and also because the choice when I joined Imad to the project he invited me was to empower his voice and to bring out to give a lot of space to tell his story, because this is what is needed politically and this is what is needed for the story, and so this will also put me in kind of the side. But then after the film was out and released, we had a lot of challenges, because a lot of people want to beautify. Oh, look, this is a nice thing to see that this film is made by an Israeli and Palestinian director. But they are not remembering that I'm there for a cause, and we're doing this collaboration in order to get the film out in Israel, in order to get the film made, and in order to change, to stop occupation, and not just to have kind of a beautiful relationship.
And we should mention that some Israelis also take part in the protests against the fence, as recorded in the film.
I think a lot of films that were done before About the occupation. Actually, we use the occupation to talk about us Israelis and to go into our self-accusations, our culpability, our morality, and our issues. And in that film, the focus was to bring it back to Palestine. So I wanted the Israeli activists that are very important in this movement to be in a very modest role.
Is it showing, Guy, in Israel?
Yeah, the film was premiered in Jerusalem Film Festival, where it won the Best Documentary Award. It then was shown in Israeli television that were co-producers for the film, and then theatrical release in Israel, and we had good partners such as the Greenhouse Project that helped us to develop the project. So we had good partners, but then again, Israeli society is not an easy society to deal with this kind of voice and this kind of narrative. So we had very, very mixed reactions. The critics like us. A lot of people who come to the film from their own will, they like the film. But the challenge is a very hard challenge. So you hear sometimes really bad reactions, and you have also some kind of really inspiring reactions.
Iman, you mentioned in the film that you got your first camera in 1995 when it was the Oslo, or had your first child in 1995 when it was the Oslo Accords period and hope was in the air. Today, obviously, is very different from all sides' point of view. Does your experience in Berlin leave you with any kind of political solutions in mind? Is it still an Oslo Camp David style two-state solution and you just have to wait for it? Or is it something else now? Or don't you even think about it at that level one way or another?
I was thinking always, and most of the Palestinians, about the agreements and the about the Oslo and other agreements that have been made with the Israelis. And since that, we just see the situation is getting worse and worse and no solution. So we don't think that there's some process or politicians are serious to make peace, especially on the Israeli side. So they just talk about, they negotiate and they talk about peace, but in the end, they just talk about security. They don't talk about the center of the story. They don't talk about the land, the settlement, the water, the borders. They don't mention this. So they just talk about security, about these things. And so people are not more hopeful about these processes of peace and the Oslo and Camp David. So
and the fact that President Obama now says he's coming to Israel and hopes to convene a Netanyahu-Abbas summit there, and the election in Israel just now where a centrist party did better than expected, does that register with you as a new sign of hope?
I don't think so. That's me. We've been following the Israel election for I'm 41 years old, and I've been following the election for more than 20, 30 years. And you feel that's the same thing and the same policy and the same strategy. And even Obama, if he come to visit in Palestine or to Israel, so I don't know what's their plans and what. So if they want to make peace and they are serious, so they can make peace from here. So
some supporters of the fence say that while Israel has built it or was building it for its own purposes, it serves a Palestinian purpose in some sense because it defines, in effect, a Palestinian state, a border, and makes it hard to expand settlements further. Any truth to that, in your opinion?
I think for us the plan to build the wall, and since the plan was already before 2000, so they started in 2002, but the purpose to build the wall and to construct the wall, it's not just security. There's many purposes: to confiscate land and to grab more land to build settlements. And you see how the settlements are growing and growing in the West Bank. So that kills the Palestinian dream to build a Palestinian state.
I gather you're going back to Palestine, and Guy, you're going on to L.A. to attend the Oscar ceremonies. What would it mean to you if you actually win the Best Documentary Oscar?
Both of us will be in the Oscars.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. Good. I'm glad you both get to go.
I think it's, well, it has a strong meaning because this is one award that actually the general audience care about. So the reaction right to the nomination was a strong interest in the film from audience that would never look at it in any other way. So this is the first thing that we got just from the nomination. And for me, two practical things that are really practical consequences that shows the power of Oscars is one is that I'm trying to promote the film and to put it in Israeli education system, which is actually has a wall. It's actually much easier probably to get into the Oscar than to put the 5 broken cameras in Israeli schools. And I've created this Indiegogo campaign in order to create this alternative program to be able to put the film in Israeli high schools to youth before they're going to do their military service, that they will see the consequences of their military service. I've created this beautiful video that document a screening that held with Israeli youth. I think it's worth watching. So you can just go in Indiegogo and look for 5 broken cameras and watch that video or decide to contribute. And the second thing is that my wish is that the film would be shown in commercial TV broadcasts, and that's something that can only be done with the Oscars. So there is a very practical meaning for me.
Imad Bernat and Guy Davidi are directors of 5 Broken Cameras, the latest guests in our Oscar series with the directors of all 5 Best Documentary nominees. The series continues tomorrow with the documentary documentary The Invisible War. And yes, please.
Yeah, just I want to say that I will be back to Los Angeles with my wife and my son Jibril. And my son Jibril, he will be the first Palestinian ever to be in the Oscar. So I hope that the Oscar draw more big attention to the Palestinian situation. So it's if we win the Oscar, so it's going to be the first Palestinian documentary wins the Oscar.
And
so
Jibril is definitely one of the stars of the movie. from ages 0 to 5 during the filming period. And it's playing now in New York City at the Quad, also available on iTunes, Hulu, Netflix. Thank you both very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now the third film in our Oscar-nominated documentary series, Invisible War. It's about the shockingly high rate of sexual assault in the U.S. military and the totally inadequate way the military deals with it. And while we didn't plan it this way, it seems fitting to have this conversation on the day when the Senate Armed Services Committee is voting to confirm or not a new Secretary of Defense. My guests are the writer and director of the film, Kirby Dick, and one of the producers, Amy Ziering. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'll start just by noting that there are some incredibly disturbing statistics in this film. 20% of female soldiers are sexually assaulted. It says somewhere around 16,000 women in the military are assaulted each year. 80% don't report it. In 25% of cases, the person they would report to is the perpetrator. And it's not even just females. Men are sexually assaulted, too. How did you come to take on this topic, Kirby?
Well, we read an article, did additional research. We're surprised that, we're surprised by the numbers. According to the Department of Defense, 19,000 men and women are sexually assaulted each year. That means hundreds of thousands over the last several decades. And we were equally surprised how unknown this was, how effectively the military had kept this under wraps and covered up.
And here are a few of the women featured in your film talking in this 40-second montage about their experiences. They are meeting here because they're filing a lawsuit against the military. Listen.
I read somewhere it was like 92% are involuntarily discharged after reporting.
Right. I don't know anybody who's actually been raped and been able to stay in the military if they reported it.
I wanted to stay in. I loved the job that I did. It made me. They made me who I was. I still wanted to do those things because that's what did make me proud, and they stripped me of everything that I did have, and it was like that was my only chance of being proud anymore. And then they just hand me my papers, and then I was...
If I have a difficult time with anything, it's about the fact that I had an almost 10-year career, which I was very invested in, and I gave that up to report a sex offender who was not even put to justice or put on the registry, and he's probably doing the same thing right now.
So that clip from the film Invisible War, correction, that was not a montage. They were in conversation with each other in that clip. But again and again in the film, you see that while the sexual assault is bad enough, what follows for these victims is worse. They are usually discharged. Sometimes they are charged with adultery, even if they're not married and the man is. One woman is denied coverage for injuries she sustained by her assailant over a year of petitioning the VA for that health coverage. And only a very small percentage of the assailants are ever punished. How is this possible, Amy, that there could be this kind of failure in a military that seems to function otherwise?
You know, I wish I had an answer to that. It was kind of staggering to discover it ourselves that as bad as the assaults were, what happened in the aftermath was, you know, by orders of magnitude even more horrific and sort of a Kafka-esque parallel universe. I mean, whenever we show the film, everyone says, I don't recognize this. I don't even comprehend or understand it. I mean, the reactions across the board, more often than not, when someone reports, is to sort of blame the victim themselves, you know, try and cover up the crime and drive the person out as opposed to prosecuting the perpetrator. Your answer as to why this happens in this way, there's certain perfect storm conditions in the military which are more conducive to this environment and these kind of things occurring than others.
Here's another clip from the film of a commander who's also the husband of Lieutenant Ariana Clay. She was sexually assaulted while stationed at the prestigious Marine Barracks, Washington. This is her husband.
This is an organization that gives commanders an unbelievable amount of power. And I felt it as a lieutenant in Iraq. It's scary. You appoint the prosecution, you appoint the defense, you appoint the investigator, you're in charge of the police force, you're in charge of the community. You own everything. You are a judge, you are a jury, you are an executioner.
And as you note, and as I said already, in 25% of cases, the person you would report the crime to, your commander, is the perpetrator. So I guess independent oversight is the key. And Kirby, I know the outgoing Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has acknowledged there is a huge problem. He screened your film, and shortly thereafter, he made policy changes. So do you think your film has already had an impact?
Oh, it certainly has had an impact in multiple ways. Not only did he elevate the decision to investigate and prosecute these crimes to the level of colonel or Navy captain, but also the military has been using the film for part of its sexual assault training. And as of this date, it's estimated that over 250,000 men and women have seen The Invisible War.
And I wonder if the Defense Department also shifted its attitude about the root causes of rape in the military. Here's another clip. It starts with a public service announcement, and then you'll hear the voice of Susan Burke, a lawyer representing victims.
Are you by yourself? Where's your buddy?
I didn't think I needed one.
Sexual assault is preventable. Are you doing your part?
And so this notion that, you know, essentially like anyone could be a rapist, we all have to be on alert, it misses an opportunity to take real steps towards preventing rape. If they actually had systems of accountability that prosecuted and imprisoned perpetrators, you would get rid of a lot of the rapes right away.
So, Amy, what that attorney is reacting to is, I guess, that the public service announcement makes it seem like it's the victims or the potential victims who need to be more careful.
Yeah, there has been a history of the wrong focus in addressing this issue within the military, where they would actually focus on how to have the potential victims prevent this crime as opposed to actually going after the perpetrators and prosecuting them, which would sort of really mostly take care of the issue. So it's that misplacement and sort of poor analysis of the situation that has led to sort of the widespread epidemic.
Though both things must be true, right? Prosecution must take place and prevention at the institutional level, but people also have to be careful in the military as in civilian life.
Yes, but it really isn't this case where if only, you know, people were more careful, this wouldn't be happening. It's not about that at that level. These perpetrators are really skilled and canny, and it's not something that usually happens in public areas where people can sort of intervene or because someone's careless. That's just a huge, huge misrepresentation of the crime.
And the film notes, Kirby, that 15% of incoming recruits have attempted or committed rape before entering the military, which is twice the rate in the civilian population. So, A, how would you even know a statistic like that? And well, B, is there a larger cultural problem here?
excuse me. These were from anonymous studies. So the military did not know that these men had committed these crimes when they came in. The problem is that most assaults, mostly sexual assaults, are committed by serial perpetrators who assault again and again. And the military has yet to improve its investigation and prosecution of these serial predators, which is why the problem continues.
Do you think that Panetta's decision to allow women to serve in every military role now, including combat roles, will change anything, Amy?
Yeah, I do. I mean, in the long run, absolutely. I mean, whenever there's an increase in equal rights to different members of any institution, that definitely improves across the board and alleviates, you know, episodes of discrimination. So, in the long run, I think it's a very good thing. In the short run, I think that obviously they really need to address the issue of sexual assault and so that all our soldiers in combat or not are equally protected and safe.
We have a few minutes with the writer and director of the film Invisible War, Kirby Dick, and one of the producers, Amy Ziering. This is one of the five films nominated for the Best Documentary Oscar. We're talking to producers and directors of all five of those films on five consecutive shows. We're at number three. We have just a couple of minutes left. A group of female soldiers who were sexually assaulted joined a lawsuit against the military. But your film reports that in December of 2011, the court dismissed the case and deemed rape an occupational hazard of being in the military. Unbelievable if that was the language. The case was appealed. Do you have an update on that case?
Well, it's oral arguments are waiting to be heard in March. That was not the exact language of the court. The language was that it was incident to military service, which is essentially the same thing. Something that happened to these women happened while they were in service, and therefore they could not sue. Those civil rights were denied.
And do you have any feeling one way or the other, Amy, about Chuck Hagel? Would he be good for this cause as defense secretary? Or do you have any indication from him one way or another that he takes it as seriously as Panetta did or as seriously as you would need him to?
Well, the only hopeful indication is that during the confirmation hearings, Senator Richard Blumenthal asked Chuck Hagel if he had seen The Invisible War, and his response was yes. So I'm hoping that, you know, I'm confident now, A, it's on his radar, and B, you know, we're going to try and, you know, keep those lines of communication open and, you know, make inroads with his offices like we did with Secretary Panetta's and keep pressure on this issue. So I don't really know, but we're hopeful that he will be as proactive on this issue as Secretary Panetta was.
Now, I'll say, though, I haven't seen all five films. I've seen some of them, and I've read a lot about all of them. My personal prediction is that you're going to win. And
wow.
So if you do, who goes on stage, and what will you say?
I hope that survivors, or two of the women in our film, can come on stage. I would love for Ariana and Corey Choka. That would just be absolutely amazing if they could come up with us. And if they spoke, I mean, I think that would be incredibly moving, and I hope your prediction's true.
I'm sure
it certainly would make a great impact in Washington if the film were to win.
How so? What do you think the additional impact could be over what the film has already done?
Well, every time there's attention paid to this film anywhere in the country, particularly at this sort of high level of publicity, activity happens in Washington. And so even the nomination generated a lot of activity. Certainly if the film were to win the award, I think there would be additional activity.
Kirby,
yeah, absolutely. It would definitely elevate this to another level and really help fuel the advocacy campaign of the film. So we're hopeful on that level. I mean, awards are nice, but that this could really give this issue an attention, widespread, global, and national attention would be a phenomenal thing.
Writer and director Kirby Dick, Amy Ziering, one of the producers of Invisible War. Good luck at the Oscars, and again, congratulations on a very important film, and thank you for coming on the show a second time to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this, our series on all five Oscar-nominated documentaries continues on tomorrow's show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now our series on the best documentary Oscar nominees continues with the fourth of five, and it's about Shin Bet, the intelligence agency charged with defending Israel against terrorism. For the last 30 years, only six men have led that organization, and my next guest interviewed all of them in his Oscar-nominated feature documentary, The Gatekeepers. Maybe a good number of you have seen it. It's been playing on the Upper West Side, and my guest is Dror Morey. Welcome back to WNYC, and congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you very much.
For our listeners not familiar, can you give a very short history of Shin Bet?
I don't know if I can give a history, but I can tell that the Shin Bet is the organization, security organization, who deals with the Palestinian conflict on all its aspects. He's the one that is responsible for maintaining intelligence in order to prevent terror from all sides, Israeli, Jews, and also from Palestinians. He's the organization who is responsible for targeted assassination of terrorists, for torturing in order to get intelligence, for all maintaining and protecting the state of Israel on any kind of threat which is coming from the Palestinian terror towards the Israelis.
So, in a way, the Israeli equivalent of the CIA.
It's a mixture of the CIA, FBI together. The Shin Bet is a very clandestine organization who deals only in the shadows. That's why it's not known as well as the Mossad. It does a lot of things that the CIA is doing, but the CIA is working outside of the U.S. The Shin Bet is working within the territories that are under military rule of the Israelis. They're not working, let's say, in other countries, which is the Mossad turf. They are working more inside the territories, the Palestinian territories, than here.
The film is all in Hebrew, so we can't play any clips. But is it fair to say that the theme is that all of these former Shin Bet leaders say Israel cannot go on with the security policies that it's pursuing?
Israel cannot go on, not with the security policy, but more cannot go on maintaining the occupation. Basically, all six men who headed that organization are saying in a loud and clear voice, enough with the occupation of the Palestinian people. It is the best way for Israel to solve that problem. And if Israel will continue to maintain that occupation, it will only lead to a disaster for the state of Israel. And this, bear in mind, coming from the center of the defense establishment in Israel, from the people who are most responsible for maintaining and arranging that conflict, especially when they are the one that are fighting. You cannot, you know, in a way, you cannot call them left-wing. They are not at all. They are more hawkish than dovish. But this is the conclusion that they've reached after all the service in the security establishment of Israel.
What do they say will happen in Israel if the occupation continues?
Well, you know, they are not prophets, but they see that the effect of that on Israeli domestic arena, the problem with the youngsters of Israel, the amount of racism that you see among the Israeli people, the moral collapsing of the Israeli people, and also internationally how Israel is being treated, the change towards Israel in the international arena in the last 45 years after the 67 war. So they see the whole basic of the whole concept of the whole conflict from all its aspects, and this is why they are afraid for the future of the state of Israel.
How specific do they get about that? Do they call for a certain kind of two-state solution or anything else?
They are very, very specific. Yes, they are calling for that Israel should do as much as it can to walk towards a two-state solution. Israel should strive for that because it's in the best interest of Israel. They're not calling it because they are leftists or they want the Palestinians to be. They are worried about the state of Israel. They are basically endorsing what President Obama is trying to create, the two-state solution. And they are calling it out and loud, clear. You know, go for a two-state solution. Try to solve it while we can. Because, you know, the more time is passing, the more difficult it is to solve that problem.
Dror, we want to call you back and see if we can get you on a better phone line. So we're going to do that right now. In the meantime, if anybody has seen The Gatekeepers and wants to react to it from any political point of view or any filmmaking point of view, 212-433-WNYC, and we'll take a call right away from Doris in Manhattan. Hi, Doris. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Drawer, congratulations on your film. And my question is, I believe that you had to shorten the interviews to make it a film length, but you have already, in Israel, you're going to put out a five-part series. I think it's for TV. Has this already been sold to the United States, and will we be able to see it with English subtitles?
Okay, Doris, thank you. And as soon as we get Drawer back on the line, we'll ask him if that's the case. And it is in the theaters with English subtitles. Right now it's at one place, as I mentioned, on the Upper West Side, which is the Lincoln Plaza Cinema. It will also start at the Film Forum in Lower Manhattan on February 20th. So this is being shown. And again, this is part of our Best Documentary Oscar series. We're interviewing the directors of all five films on five consecutive days. This is the fourth out of the five, and we're just trying to get a better phone line to Tel Aviv for the director, Drawer Moray, of The Gatekeepers. And I want to ask him how this is being received in Israel. Maybe it's more shocking for people in the United States to hear the head of their intelligence agencies, or I should say all six former heads of their intelligence agency dating back to 1980, question whether the occupation, the way it's continuing, is in Israel's interest or not. Maybe it's less shocking in Israel to hear that than it is for people in the United States. Art in Chelsea, you're on WNYC. Hello, Art.
Thanks so much. I've seen the film, and I think it's designed to perpetuate a myth that if only Israel would leave the occupied territories, everything would be fine. They left Gaza. They left southern Lebanon. Both areas were turned into armed camps. And that is the essential problem. The problem is not whether Israelis would like to have a Palestinian state over there. They'd be happy to have a peaceful one. There seems to be no way in the world to obtain that.
Art, I haven't seen the film yet, so I can't say how these former Shin Bet heads articulate what they say, but presumably they're all concerned about Israel's long-term security, too, after a Palestinian state is created. Did they change you in any way? Was there anything that surprised you that came out of the mouths of these particular people considering what they've done?
It sounded like excerpts were chosen from what they said to create a certain political point of view in the mind of the viewer of the film.
Ah, so you think it was selectively edited, perhaps?
Extremely.
Art, thank you for your call, and I think we have the director back now, Drawer Moray. Drawer, were you able to hear that last question?
Yeah, but I think that this question or what the statement that was prior to where I am is really not the truth. All six heads of the Shin Bet have seen the movie. They are firmly and strongly standing behind it and behind the message that it bears within. It was not cherry-picked in order to serve my purpose. And I think that he has to deal with the message that comes from the movie and not try to say that the messenger is the one to blame with the message. I think that he doesn't understand really the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I think that if there is something that I tried or that surprised me completely while creating that movie and doing the interviews, is that the fact that those six men who were very, very close to the Prime Minister have said repeatedly that it's not that they are saying that tomorrow if they will start a peace talk, peace will strive or everything will be fine. On the contrary, they know and understand how difficult it is to reach peace. They know and understand how much the Palestinians are a difficult client to reach peace with, but having said that, all of them said, are we a good client? Are we easy client to reach peace with? Look, there is 500,000 settlers in the West Bank now which do not want to be evacuated and to create what should be the Palestinian state. So those gatekeepers are saying that, and they are saying that it is for the best interest of Israel to try to reach peace. They're not saying that it could be reached very easily. They're not saying that, but they're saying that the Israeli politicians have to do that in order to preserve the Jewish democratic state as a Jewish state for the sake of the people who live in Israel, not those who live in New Jersey or in America.
Has Prime Minister Netanyahu reacted to this film?
From what I understood, Prime Minister Netanyahu's spokesman said that he's not interested to see the film, and he's not going to, so I would say that this shows a little bit about the man, not about the film. This is six head of the Israeli defense establishment, the center core of the Israeli defense establishment. If there is someone who understands the Israeli-Palestinian conflict better than anybody else in the world, it's those six people who are speaking in the film. Nobody beside them understands that question and that conflict better than them. And they are coming and saying in a loud and clear voice, enough of the occupation. This is the worst thing for Israel's sake and security. Not coming from being, you know, left-wing or didn't. They are the ones that have done all their life spent in order to protect the state of Israel. And this is their message.
Gideon in Stamford. You're on WNYC. Hello, Gideon.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I'm an ex-member of Kibbutz Kerem Shalom from the 70s. And Ador would probably know the name, recognize the name, Kibbutz Kerem Shalom.
Okay, and what do you want to say?
Well, I want to say we were fighting for that solution in the 70s, we were very, very few people back then. And I just wonder, why did it take so long? Now the solution is so late, and personally, I don't believe it would happen without heavy involvement of the Arab countries. Because Israel alone cannot solve that problem anymore.
Gideon, thank you very much. And it's such a big historical question. I don't know that we have time, really, to give him a decent answer.
I totally agree with Gideon, and I would add to that I think that unless the international community, headed by the U.S., headed by the White House, with the Germans, the French, all the Western countries, would put an enormous amount of pressure on both sides on the ground, the Palestinian and the Israelis, to reach a solution, nothing will happen. I think that those two parties cannot do that by themselves. They need a lot of help from outside, and I hope that the international community will do that, especially President Obama.
Do you yourself, and I realize you're a filmmaker, not a political analyst, but do you yourself see any movement toward that right now after the Israeli election, in which the pro-negotiation centrist party did surprisingly well, and with President Obama coming to Israel for the first time in his presidency and hoping to stage a Netanyahu-Abbas summit? A lot of analysts here say Obama isn't really going there to try to launch a new peace process. He's really going there just to mend fences with Netanyahu. But what do you think?
I really hope that this will happen. I think that the Israeli election have sent a very clear message to Netanyahu that they want him to go center and not to the extreme right that he wanted to go. I hope that he understands that message. And I really, really hope that President Obama is coming to Israel to deal also with the peace process and the maintaining or continuing or building the beginning of a peace process. I think that if he is not doing that, he is doing a grave mistake, which will haunt Israel and the American very, very soon. The clouds for the third intifada, as one of the head of the Shin Bet have said, are gathering on the horizon. And unless America, headed by President Obama, will put a huge pressure in order to maintain or to start in a way the peace process, I think that the future is gloomy to all of us here.
Have many people in Israel seen your film? You said Prime Minister Netanyahu has declared his lack of interest in seeing it. Is your film showing widely in Israel, and is it a topic of national debate?
Absolutely. The film is now being seen in around 50,000 Israelis have watched it in the cinema. It opened only 1 month ago. It's a huge amount for a documentary in Israel. The debate in the television, the debate in the newspaper, in the column writer, the debate in the public is huge about the film, and a lot of people are watching it, are relating to it, and I hope that it will create, or it has created already, the buzz that I thought it will create because of the personas that are speaking in it for the first time.
One more call for you. Jan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. You saw the film, right?
Yes, I did, twice.
Twice? And?
Yep, excellent film, Dror.
Thank you very much.
And you have a question, right?
Yes, I do. The thing that most interested me was the way that you handled the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the implication that I thought I understood from your film that this has had tremendous impact on the body politic in Israel in a way that we don't understand here in America. Could you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, which for me was the most terrible event in modern Israel's history, was created or was perpetrated by Jewish extreme right-wing settlers and who believe that no Israeli can give up the land of Israel toward the Gentile. They are motivated by messianic, biblical mission, and they cannot understand or take any kind of even democratic decision by an elected government that is opposing their biblical mission. And this is the most greatest danger to the peace process, because whenever there are those kind of movements towards creating peace, those extreme right-wing religious people are coming and saying this is against the God, against the law of the Torah, of the Bible, and no Jew can do that without being prosecuted or being created something that can hinder his life. And this is the reason why they have assassinated Prime Minister Rabin. And if you ask me today, also between the disengagement, the threat on Eric Sharon's life from extreme right Jews were much more graver than the one that was on Prime Minister Rabin prior to his assassination. So you can see that whenever there is a movement towards peace, those extreme right-wing, radical, religious Orthodox are waking up to say enough, and they are willing to danger everything in order to stop that, including bombing the Temple Mount, by the way.
Let me ask you, unless you have to go and answer your phone, one final question, and it's really an Oscar politics question. Among the five best documentary nominees are yours in Hebrew and the one from the Palestinian filmmaker's perspective in Arabic. Do you think you cancel out each other's possibility of actually winning the Oscar?
I'm not an analyst. Maybe I can give a lot of advices on politics in Israel, but on Oscar policy, I cannot really answer that. I hope that the best film will win, and that I think, is the best policy for the Oscars. Maybe the best win one.
In our last 15 seconds or so, what will you, because that's how much you would get, what would you say on stage if you win the Oscar?
I would dedicate this film to the assassinated Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, who dared to think and dream peace and paid a very dear price for that. I think that he was an extraordinary leader, another extraordinary leader that was assassinated because he dared to dream peace was Anwar Sadat. And regrettably, all the people, all the leaders that are brave enough to dream peace, to try to bring this troubled region into peace, into living a normal life, always assassinated by extreme religious fanatics.
Dror Morey, director of The Gatekeepers, one of the five best documentary nominees at the Oscars this year. The Gatekeepers is playing at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema and will start at the Film Forum on February 20th. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for that conversation.
It's The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and now the last in our series on Best Documentary Oscar nominees. David France is with us. He's the director of How to Survive a Plague, which is the story of the early days of the AIDS epidemic and ACT UP, the grassroots organization in New York, of course, that in the 80s and 90s advocated for treatments for HIV, among other things. David France, welcome back to WNYC, and congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you. How cool is that?
And it is, I'm sure, never having had the experience, that it is totally cool to be nominated for an Oscar. And it's a really moving film for anyone in New York in the 80s and 90s. You folks will remember the rallying cry, ACT UP, Fight Back, Fight AIDS, and the footage in this film will be familiar, a lot of it. You have footage of early demonstrations, early ACT UP meetings in Greenwich Village, plus private home video footage of some of the key activists, which really makes this uniquely personal. Right. And before we play some clips, for those who don't know, How do you look back on ACT UP's original mission and who the people were?
Well, you know, ACT UP began in 1987, and that was already 6 years into the plague in New York, and already tens of thousands had gotten sick and died. And they began with a great and roiling rage. And we remember that from the first year or two, that it was really a protest movement. It was really saying, stop doing what you're doing, start doing what you need to be doing. And then ultimately, the strategy refined, and they began to, in their confrontations and encounters with the officials and scientists, be very specific about what they wanted done, what they wanted researched, how they wanted those things researched, how they wanted them regulated and ultimately released. So the story of AIDS activism is really one of a forced and ultimately very productive partnership with researchers that helped bring about the drug breakthroughs in 96 that ended the plague years and made it finally possible to survive an HIV infection.
You do a really good job of showing how the strategy took shape. They realized early on that they needed to learn the science. Mm-hmm. They enlisted a couple of key scientists and doctors to help them understand how to bring a drug to market, how to research illness. And this became the treatment and data team of ACT UP, which mm-hmm. is really central to the film. And I want to play a clip of Mark Harrington, one of the key activists on the treatment and data team. This is after they had won a victory at the National Institutes of Health headquarters in Bethesda, the approval of a drug that they wanted for treatment.
It was really an amazing encounter, but it sort of felt like reaching the Wizard of Oz. Like, you got to the center of the whole system, and there's just this schmuck behind a curtain. There was no guiding agenda. There was no leadership. There was no global strategy for how to deal with AIDS in the U.S. And so on the bus back from Bethesda, we decided to write a treatment agenda because nobody was dealing with the entire map of AIDS, the entire constellation of opportunistic infections, the gaps in research, the underrepresented populations, the fact that the diseases and the drugs might be different in those populations. How would we ever find out? They weren't even being studied.
Mark Harrington from How to Survive a Plague. And this is one of the turning points, and director David France is with us. One of the many moments in the film when you realize how hard this fight was and that lesser men and women might not have persevered. And you realize that these people were fighting for the whole community, but they were also fighting for their lives.
For their own lives, absolutely.
How did ACT UP change after they drafted this treatment agenda?
The clip that you just played is from a juncture in activism where they finally get through the doors and they see on the other side of the doors what they took initially to be the enemy, and then they realize that they were just human beings trying to do the right thing but without a game plan and without leadership. And so they began at that moment to forge this partnership. They presented the treatment agenda that he described at the International AIDS Conference in Montreal, first time they went in and actually spoke directly to the scientists who were doing the bench work in the laboratories. And it was a clash of cultures. You see it in the film, which is pieced together with all this kind of vintage footage. You see that they're, you know, downtown New York, gay men with pierced ears and black army boots arriving in the middle of this very tweedy establishment.
Science conference.
Scientists,
yeah.
Right. And they make this presentation, and people are really afraid of them. And one scientist, and we see this in the film, one scientist from the NIH is intrigued but scared. So she sneaks around and tries to get a copy of this treatment agenda without actually engaging this alien body. and she starts to read it, and her first thought is, oh, they're wrong. They're just, you know, what do they think they're doing? And the deeper she gets into the agenda, the more she realizes that that she really didn't know about the lack of, you know, a certain kind of humane aspects to research. And she started as a biostatistician to think they had something that they could contribute. Mm. And she was the first person to invite them in, a small group, into her AIDS statistical working group at the NIH. And that began those were the first kind of baby steps of this partnership, this real working together.
It's a great moment. Listeners, call us up. If you were part of ACT UP or just around in those days, central to or on the peripheral of the AIDS epidemic, in New York or anywhere, 212-433-WNYC. Or if you've already seen the movie, How to Survive a Plague, and you want to talk to director David France, 212-433-9692, as we have spoken to the directors of all five Best Documentary Oscar nominees over the last five shows. And this wraps it up with this one, which is so close to home here in New York. Mm-hmm. Call up if you want to chime in, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Another clip. There was a rift that developed within ACT UP. Many thought that the treatment and data team were getting too close to pharmaceutical companies. I remember having this conversation back then with doctors who had practices in Chelsea, you know, and were treating people with AIDS and certainly supported the larger agenda of ACT UP and patient participation in politics and science, but were also concerned that an activist group was getting too close to pharmaceutical companies that had their own agendas and reasons for wanting to push drugs through to approval very quickly, safe or not. And they were becoming, allegedly, this wing of ACT UP, this elite group. So this is a clip from an ACT UP meeting in 1989 in the film. I think this is 1991, but you'll tell me, where everyone was fighting. And the speaker is AIDS activist icon Larry Kramer, breaking through the noise.
Plague! We are in the middle of a f***ing plague! And you behave like this! Plague! 40 million infected people is a f***ing plague! We are in the worst shape we have ever, ever, ever been in. All those pills we're shoveling down our throats, forget it. ACT UP has been taken over by a lunatic fringe. They can't get together. Nobody agrees with anything. All we can do is field a couple hundred people at a demonstration. That's not going to make anybody pay attention. Not until we get millions out there. We can't do that. All we do is pick at each other and yell at each other. And I say to you in year 10, the same thing I said to you in 1981 when there were 41 cases. Until we get our acts together, all of us, we are as good as dead.
Larry Kramer from the early 90s, from the documentary How to Survive a Plague. And David, at this point, TAG, the Treatment Action Group, actually splits off from the rest of ACT UP?
It does. You were right to point out that that conflict and the suspicions that started to develop when this strategy that ACT UP ultimately improvised of having an inside wing and an outside wing started looking at one another as kind of as too extreme, either too extremely inside and potentially co-opted by the authorities, or too outside and too invested in street protest and chaining themselves to things. And there came a proposal that really underscored this distrust. And it was a proposal on the floor of ACT UP that they adopt a moratorium of working with government officials and pharmaceutical officials for a 6-month period. Hmm. And that although the motion didn't pass, it was the event that cleaved the organization in two, and the inside strategy wing spun off and became the Treatment Action Group, still around today, and more of a think tank, and it's certainly a group that sees the benefit of working as self-trained kind of science experts in this area with the scientists who are identifying new compounds and approaches.
And did it all become moot because then science got lucky, or I don't know if lucky doesn't give them enough credit, on the research front, and the protease inhibitors came in?
Well, these folks from the Treatment and Data Committee, later TAG, were working very closely with the scientists who were identifying protease as a possible target for an anti-HIV drug, and helped in the early research. Ultimately, it was the Treatment Action Group, and in fact, one Spencer Cox, one of the members of the group, who designed the drug trial protocol that was adopted by industry when the protease inhibitors came online, so that we could get broad and reliable information very quickly about the drug. And so this interaction was really essential in that moment that helped bring those drugs to market so quickly in 96, and that ultimately, you know, emptied the hospitals. There was an 80% drop in death rates over the next 18 or 24 months. So that was really effective. But that organization has kept working on new compounds, on new approaches, and ACT UP and TAG on both sides of that divide helped spawn the treatment action campaigns that are that took hold thereafter in Africa and part of the developing world that kind of exported this idea that patients should have a voice in the research and access issues around the disease.
David France, director of How to Survive a Plague, Best Documentary, nominee 212-433-WNYC, Michael in Clifton. You're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to say how much I love the movie, and it parallels my story as well. I was diagnosed HIV in 1988, and although my health remained very good until 95, where my T-cells dropped dramatically, there was very little hope for anyone at that point, and it was a matter of, you know, watching your health deteriorate. And in 96, when the protease inhibitors came on the market, that was the first time that there was hope, and here it is many years later, and my health is excellent. And
fantastic.
The movie, I thought, really exemplified the experience of so many gay men in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, thank you.
Michael, thank you. Thank you. Good to hear you sounding so good.
Absolutely.
Deanna in Hicksville, you're on WNYC. Hello, Deanna.
Hi. I just wanted to thank David for reminding people what this is all about. I lost my uncle in just past New Year's in 1992, so he was sort of the first wave, and watching this movie and watching these people and sort of putting my own personal timeline along with theirs was such a moving experience, and I'm so grateful that even though I watched most of the movie with my hand in my mouth to keep from sobbing, to remind New York City and remind people, you know, all over the country who really, I don't think, see AIDS the same way anymore, because luckily we've come up with so many new treatments and new ways to fight it, but just remind them that it's there.
Absolutely.
And that it's taken so much already, and it was just, man, I hope you win that Oscar so much. Nobody deserves it more.
I hope you have clout. I hope that works.
Deanna, thank you so much.
Now, as I've always said about this film, that if you think you know the history of AIDS, and most people do, that this film will surprise you, that it's really a story about a community of real heroes coming together on all sides, including the scientists, including the regulators, finding that and harnessing their heroic powers to make this thing happen when it would not ordinarily have happened. 8 million people alive today on those drugs.
And beyond being a good history of this particular movement, the film provides a good education about how to build a successful movement, period.
Right.
Was that one of your goals?
Well, it certainly was something that I discovered as I was doing the research to produce the documentary, that in fact it was a new paradigm for kind of grassroots social movements, hugely successful and innovative and, you know, triumphant ultimately, but that simply as a model, it offers a blueprint for so many other movements, and in fact is being very consciously replicated in places like Moscow, where the pro-democracy movement is looking to the history of ACT UP. And in fact, staging underground screenings of How to Survive a Plague as a way to try to improvise their own strategies in their own demonstrations.
And what about right here with the Occupy movement and the marriage equality movement? You were making and promoting this film while both were extremely active.
Absolutely.
Do you think they have learned from ACT UP success? Did you see ACT UP reflected in either of those movements recently?
Of course. And in fact, in both of them, the Occupy Wall Street movement, I found even interesting in the way the media handled them. That, you know, the media didn't treat ACT UP well. It considered ACT UP a group of troublemakers who were just screaming and just trying to disrupt ordinary life, because they had nothing else to do to try to express their grief. And they were roundly dismissed throughout their heyday in the 80s and 90s. And we saw that happen with the Occupy movement in the early stages, where they were, you know, cast as, you know, this kind of shirtless encampment of kind of proto-hippies. And But the other thing we learned, and it's parallel, is that the first year or two of ACT UP really didn't get traction. It didn't get the kind of traction it needed to get, much like the early stages of Occupy. And it wasn't except for the perseverance that they really were able to show, that they were able to make those kind of inroads that they needed to make.
You talk about the media portraying ACT UP in the early days as troublemakers, but they were also out to be troublemakers. And I wonder if you think that angering people was useful, or if you look back on that as you made this film and decided that they didn't need to anger people staging something in the middle of St. Patrick's Cathedral, mm-hmm. or some of the other things that they did that got a lot of press, but negative press, because right. they really enraged people. They didn't just say, hey, folks, take our epidemic seriously.
Exactly. They did both of those things, right? So the first thing that they had to do as activists was to speak somehow over the heads of officials and through the media to the American people to say, look, you know, we are just sick people who want pills. But in order to get those pills, they had to fight all those other institutions, including the Catholic Church. And the point in demonstrations at the church was that the church was making an argument about condoms that was untenable scientifically and in public health measures. And they wanted to bring the argument right to the cardinal in New York. And they did get press on that issue. They unfortunately also got press on their apparent willingness to cross over any line to get their point across. And people like Larry Kramer say that in fact was a key victory for them, to make people afraid of them, that fear was part of the arsenal that they were using in their struggle. And you see how the fear worked in Big Pharma when they were confronting them about the way that they were researching or not researching drugs. But it was always a stick with a carrot. And that was the inside wing, was the group saying, look, we're mad at you for not doing it, but if you do it, we can help you through the FDA process in record time. We can start building profits for you if you develop drugs that are even partially effective in the marketplace.
All right. One more clip. This is Peter Saleh, who was one of the lead activists in ACT UP.
And we have to leave a legacy to the generations of people who will come after us. Remember that someday the AIDS crisis will be over. And when that day has come and gone, there will be a people alive on this earth, gay people and straight people, black people and white people, men and women, who will hear the story that once there was a terrible disease, and that a brave group of people stood up and fought, and in some cases died, so that others might live and be free.
Peter Saleh from the Best Documentary nominated film at the Oscars, How to Survive a Plague. David France, the director, has been with us. I think it's between you and Invisible War. We'll see what happens on a week from Sunday night. What will you say on stage if you win, and who would be going up there with you?
Oh, it's hard even to think forward like that, and I do worry about jinxing things. So I haven't written anything. I know that just the opportunity to have the film even mentioned there brings, you know, the issue of AIDS back to an incredibly broad audience. A billion people will hear that there are still people out there concerned about this disease, and that would be fantastic. And I'll certainly go up with my producer, Howard Gertler, without whom this couldn't have happened, but also with Peter Staley, who you just listened to, and with Joy Thompson, our executive producer. And we'll go up there if we're given the chance, and we'll remind the world that, just as Peter was saying, once there was a brave group of people who stood up and fought so that we could all survive this disease, or potentially have that available to us.
The DVD release is February 26th, by the way. You can see it on Netflix, iTunes. I noticed that on my cable system, it's available as a pay-per-view film.
It is.
So, David France, good luck and thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Brian.